We're in 2 Corinthians chapter 1. We'll begin reading in verse 1. Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, by the will of God, and Timothy our brother, unto the church of God which is at Corinth, with all the saints which are in all Achaia. Grace be to you and peace from God our Father and from the Lord Jesus Christ. Blessed be God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort, who comforteth us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort them which are in any trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. For as the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our consolation also aboundeth by Christ. And whether we be afflicted, it is for your consolation and salvation, which is effectual in the enduring of the same sufferings which we also suffer. Or whether we be comforted, it is for your consolation and salvation. And our hope of you is steadfast, knowing that as ye are partakers of the sufferings, so shall ye be also of the consolation. For we would not, brethren, have you ignorant of our trouble which came to us in Asia, that we were pressed out of measure, above strength, insomuch that we despaired even of life. But we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God which raises the dead. So what we're looking at here in 2 Corinthians is we're going to take Paul's writings of the workings of the ministry. He is carrying out the mandate, bringing the people to Christ. He's bringing the what we call the gospel, or the good news. The good news is forgiveness of sins. All of us have it. All of us in one time or another have experienced guilt, unless your conscience is seared so bad that it's as a stone. But I think for the most part, everybody here is relatively decent people, and all of us have a conscience that works. And so when we look at it, we're all in one group. We've all sinned, and we've all felt guilt before. So when you look at the gospel, the story of Jesus Christ, the death, the burial, the resurrection, Jesus dying on the cross, everyone in this room is familiar with it at least, but there is a whole herd of people that are not familiar with the whole story. So it's our obligation as a church, or it's our commission, it's our mandate, is to go out and to tell these people the good news. You can have forgiveness of sins, which is good news. I mean, who wouldn't want to hear that? That isn't bad news, it's not dangerous news, it's not threatening news, but it's called the good news. But as we look through this passage, at least in this paragraph, we find that there's opposition. In fact, you'll see that there is opposition to the point of suffering. Now, we already know that the apostles, for this mandate, for their commission, all went to their death. They were martyrs. So the good news that you would think would be relatively well received was not only not received, but it was to the point of hostility, of murder. And so we see here in our paragraph, there is suffering that Paul talks about. But we also notice a second thing in here is that there's a division. If you look at verse 8, he writes, "For we would not, brethren, have you ignorant." There is suffering that he's discussing, but there's a division here at the church at Corinth compared to the author of the letter, Paul the Apostle. And what he is saying is we are suffering. And if you go back to the first letter, he says, we suffer terribly, but you guys are reigning. You're like kings in the church. But other people within the church, the apostles namely, but others, are suffering. So there's a division even amidst this suffering. Some people aren't suffering. And some people are suffering so bad, he says here in this letter, that it says in the end of verse 8, that we were even despaired even of life. I mean, there is just a terrible suffering for simply trying to tell people the good news. Let's look at the first verse, because this is important in his greeting in 1 Corinthians 1. He says, "Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, by the will of God, and Timothy our brother." Now he's writing this letter, it says, "unto the church of God, which is at Corinth." Now, we know by now Caesar Augustus has divided what we know now of the country of Greece. Back then it was a state within the Roman Empire, so it wasn't an individual, necessarily a nation. It was more as what we would call a state. But by now Caesar Augustus has divided this area into two provinces. We have in the north, the northern half of Macedonia and Achaia. Then the southern province would be Corinth and Athens. And so we have these divisions here, but we're familiar just from 7th grade history of Athens and Greece. We're familiar what took place there. And so when you're looking at this, now the church at Corinth, being in the southern province along with Athens, is a sister city. And so Corinth and Athens are the center of academia. This is where Aristotle and Socrates and all the philosophy that came from the Grecian area of the world in the Roman Empire. And so what we're looking at now, and we have to keep in our mind, is when we're looking, when Paul writes this letter to the church at Corinth, then it is similar to that of Athens. And so what we have to keep in mind is we're looking at probably what we would call in today is an Ivy League town. So it's a town, a community that would surround the university. And we know what that's like. You have a whole lot of professors around. You have people who are studying for their PhDs. They're studying philosophy. And so it's a highly academic town. And in so doing then, it's also then a highly affluent town. So with that then, in the back of our mind, let's go then over to Acts 17. And see as Paul addresses his method of giving the gospel out here at Athens. So we come in Acts 17 and verse 15, it says, "And they that conducted Paul brought him unto Athens, receiving a commandment unto Silas and Timothy, for to come to him with all speed they departed. Now, while Paul waited for them at Athens, he was stirred in the spirit." His spirit was stirred in him. When I'm reading through these historical narratives, this is, it plays out for me in a movie. So in your mind, you have to have a little bit of smoke. What you're seeing is a lot of people around in what they would call togas or tunics. You see a lot of the marble statues that remind us of the Grecian Empire. Marble statues generally that were, the men were half naked and they just have their toga wrapped around them. But for some of our children, we would say this is almost an obscene statue. But that is very common in the Grecian Empire, mainly because homosexuality is prevalent without the Roman Empire, and her sister, pedophilia, is also prevalent within the empire. We make that connection, don't we? Homosexuality and pedophilia go hand in hand. And so what we have is these statues, mostly of half-naked men showing these things, and some of them actually are naked boys. And so we see this in our mind as we're looking. Paul is now here at Athens, and he's about to give the good news, forgiveness of sins. So much so it says that his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry, worshiping of statues. So he goes in, he puts on his gear, and he starts to advance for the kingdom. Verse 17, "Therefore disputed he in the synagogues with the Jews and with the devout persons," people of any kind of significance, "and in the market daily with them that met with him." So Paul is just trying to talk to just about anybody. If you're significant or insignificant, if he's in the marketplace, it's like going to the West Side Market down in Cleveland, you bump into somebody and you're trying to strike up a conversation concerning Jesus. Verse 18, "Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him and said," now look what their first response is, "what will this babbler say?" Why the attitude? Because that's usually how the attitude of the elite are, isn't it? We're entering into the elitism of it, and immediately he is approached with arrogancy. "I don't need to hear this stuff. I am doing well on my own. I have no problem singing Frank Sinatra. I do it my way and not in a shy way." So what will this babbler say? So already we have opposition. This babbler, he seemeth to be a setter forth of some kind of strange gods, I don't know, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection. Some strange god of this Jesus and the resurrection. He's giving the simple gospel. Jesus died on the cross, rose from the dead. Nothing complicated. Very simple. An innocent man died for our sins and rose 3 days later from the grave. Everyone here is familiar with that. And it's a good message. It's the good news. Forgiveness of sins. Believe on the Lord Jesus and thou shalt be saved. So it goes down a little further in verse 22. He comes across a little area of town there called Mars Hill. It says, "Paul, stood in the midst of Mars Hill, and he begins to speak. Now, Mars Hill for us in our own day is what we would find somewhere near University Circle. We're down near the university, but let's just picture for our own scene. Again, there's men in togas, women in togas around. You have statues of the marbles. And then what we have is a modern-day Starbucks that has a big, large outdoor patio that everyone is gathered around in because it's just about let off work time. Rush hour is beginning. It's beginning to be full with people all buying their lattes and their grande Americanas in a mug with just a little bit of room for cream. And then they're walking around and they're sipping it, talking about how they are working on their PhD and that, Here's the place where Paul, he's just going to stand up and speak. Because the truth is everybody needs to hear this. Whether they like it or not, they need to hear it. They all have a plague within them called sin, and they all are about to die and perish. Now, they don't know it, but they do. Now, we all know we're going to die. That we do. Although most of us try to skirt the issue like we're going to live forever. But the truth is we're all going to die and we all have sins to account for. So we're going to stand before God and give an account, whether we like it or not or admit it or not. But the truth is Paul has the medicine and so do we. How would you like to step into a Starbucks that is well crowded out on the porch when there's people all over the place who have PhDs and can speak proper English when us hillbillies, we don't even know the difference between we and we're and them and this. So this is what he does. He stands up and he says, "Ye men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you're too superstitious. For because I passed by and beheld your devotions and I found an altar with this inscription." Another statue. Paul calls it an altar. He says, this inscription says, "To the unknown God." They know that God is out there. Like the God, you know, the God, you know, like God. We have a lot of little gods that we like to have, our statues. But down deep inside, every person knows that there is a real God. There's no such thing as atheists. They're just liars. They all know, so do they. So they erect this statue just in case. You know, we've got to knock on wood, we don't crawl under ladders, and we certainly don't want to break a mirror because they're superstitious. So just in case we don't offend the real God, you know, the unknown one, they built an altar to him. And it says, the inscription, "To the unknown God." And Paul says, okay, this is the one we need to talk about. He says, "Whom therefore you ignorantly worship." You're worshiping him, but ignorantly. "Him declare I unto you." And then we don't want to go through the whole thing just for time's sake. But in verse 24, he says, this is the creator God. This is the God that made the world and all things therein. Yes. And so what he's doing is he's getting them to nod their head. Yes, I agree with that. This is the creator God. This is the one, the big one. Verse 26, he says something universal. "And this God hath made of one blood all nations of men." We can agree with that. We all know we're really all of one blood. There's different races, different nationalities, different ethnicities and things. But at the end of the day, we're all sons of Adam. So at the end of the day, we are really all one big human race created by God himself. So what he's doing is Paul's getting them to do this. Yeah. I agree with that so far. Verse 28, not only is he the creator, he's the sustainer of all things. God keeps the world going. "For in him we live and move and have our being, as certain also." And then he quotes from one of their poets, because Paul isn't actually as ignorant as he looks. He may not speak very elegantly, but he's not a dummy. And so he quotes from one of their own poets. He says, "As certain also of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring." You guys know these things. You don't want to admit it, but you know it. One of your poets actually published it. Look at it now. "Forasmuch then as we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that God, the Godhead, is like unto gold or silver or stone or graven by art or a man's device." You guys know that God is God. Why would you make a stone or a little statue and think that that's God? It's ridiculous. Isn't that ridiculous? How can anybody possibly say, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a statue and carve it up or a piece of wood and I'm going to turn this into my God. I'm going to worship this stone or statue. That's ridiculous. And what's even more ridiculous is the people who are doing it are the people with PhDs. So these are highly educated people. And he actually says, this is just ignorance. He says in verse 30, this is the time of ignorance. So you'd have to ask yourself, why? Why would they be so ignorant? Look at 32. It says, and when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, they mocked him. Why? Why would they do that? Verse 5 of chapter 18. And when Silas and Timotheus were come from Macedonia, Paul was pressed in the spirit. You know, the guy actually genuinely cares. And it says, and he testified to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. Now look what they do. All he says is, this is actually your Messiah, the one that you've been looking for the whole time. This isn't new news to you. This is what we've been talking about since Moses, the deliverer. So he was pressed in the spirit to tell them. And look at the response. It says, and when they opposed themselves and blasphemed, why would you oppose yourself? What would make you blaspheme? It's not a matter of education, because they're educated people. These are the smart people of academics. These are people who have studied philosophy. They have mathematics under their belt. They have science under their belt. Why would they capitulate to such ignorance? This is the Harvard people. Why, though, is the question. Why do they oppose so drastically? Well, we're told in Ephesians chapter 2, where Paul writes to the church at Ephesus, if you just turn over there, he tells us a few things. Because you have to know your audience. If you go to school and they teach you, the speaker, that you have to know your audience. You know, we can't speak over people's heads, and we don't want to treat people like fools. So you have to know your audience. And this will tell you why the response is what it is. This is why you can talk about anything in the Cleveland area, but you can't talk about two things, politics and religion. Why? Because we're too stupid? No. The religion part is because we find in Ephesians chapter 2, he says, and you hath he quickened, made alive, an old English word, who were dead in trespasses and sins. The reason that there's opposition to the gospel, the good news, is because the people that we're giving it to are spiritually dead inside. That's what he says. You were dead in trespasses and sins. There's something dead within us, and you're poking a corpse. It's irritating already. Go back to Adam and Eve. The day that you eat the fruit thereof, thou shalt surely die. Did they die that day? No. But they did. Something on the inside died that day. And you know what the first response was? They hid. So God comes walking in the cool of the day of the garden, like he always has, and walks with them. And what does he say? Adam, where are you? He said, well, I hid myself. Why? Well, because something is wrong. And you're hiding from God, the one who walked with him every day in the cool of the garden. It's one of his best friends. Adam's best friend before Eve was God himself. So his best friend that he's very well acquainted with, he's now hiding from. And he's actually ashamed. Because there's something dead on the inside that all non-believers have. And he says, we were like that too, because we're all in the same boat. And so what he says then, you had the quickened who were dead in trespasses and sins, where in time past you walked, look at this, according to the course of this world. Now, look at that again. In time past, when we were dead in trespasses and sins, we weren't alive spiritually. It says, we walked in time past according to the course of this world. So the idea there is there's a course. The world is all on this course, and everybody in the world is walking there. Pink Floyd. Don't you all know that you're just another brick in the wall? How astute. All you are is just another brick in the wall. You're blindly marching to the drumbeat of the world. Everybody's doing it. There's like this invisible leading of marching where everybody is going the same direction, doing the same things. It's as if there's just something in the air. And actually, there is. That's what the verse says. Look, he says, wherein in time past you walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince and the power of the air. The prince here is the devil himself. That's the demonic prince, the prince and the power of the air. So according to the course of this world, according to the prince and power of the air, the spirit that now worketh in the children of disobedience, among whom, because we would say this is where the rub is, I'm not a child of disobedience. I'm a good guy. And you are lying. Because there ain't none of us good. No, not one. That's why the next verse says, among whom also we all had our conversation in time past, in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and the mind. What Paul says is actually, you all have a dirty mind. Now, men worse than women, but women too. We all have dirty minds, and we know it. Could you imagine if whatever it is that we were thinking throughout the day came through on the screen that's behind me? How embarrassed we would all be. That's what's within us. That is the spirit of disobedience. That is part of the death that is within us. So when you hear the actual good news of the gospel, the opposition begins. So then when we can come back and make our conclusion then, in our letter to Corinth, there's suffering. Paul says, we have to go out and tell people who are dying, who are unbelievers, who are unconverted, we have to go give them the medicine. They don't even know that they have cancer, but they do. They're going to die and perish, and they don't know it. So we must not only tell them that, but we must give them the medicine. And as you begin to give them the medicine, there's an absolute hostility against the good news, forgiveness of sin. So much so that Paul is suffering to the point he says, we even despaired of life. But I want you to notice, though, there's still this division in verse 8. For we would not, brethren, have you ignorant. And he's talking to the church. Why would a church be ignorant? I mean, I can understand if everybody out there is ignorant. They're just on their way to Walmart and could care less. But we're here on Sunday morning doing what we're supposed to do. So how is it that there's this division where Paul and the boys are suffering terribly and the rest of the churches are fine? And I've used the illustration before, but I used it again because it's a great illustration. And to be honest, I didn't make it up, so I can use it as many times as we want and then say it's my own. But in the olden days, in the ancient times, the marinas that we're familiar with, marinas were different then. Marinas were for commercial use. They were for financial use. The marinas were strictly for when the big freighters that are coming in that are powered by the air only back in the old days, there weren't steam or nuclear ships, but they were all reliant upon air. And so this big, huge sailing vessels that were bringing in all the commerce would come. But when they hit rough seas and things became bad, that was our livelihood. That was our sustenance. And so the marinas were full of small boats then that could head out of the marina and head out to save them and to save the crew, save the passengers, save the food, save everything that was there. And then they would finally come back and bring them safely into port. But as time went on, marinas changed. Now marinas are full of what? Rich people in boats. In fact, now we've introduced something new called the yacht club. Make the connection. Who goes to the yacht club but the wealthy? The church at Corinth is a sister to Athens, full of PhDs and people of wealth and elite. What used to be something that brought people to safety is now a yacht club. And they had really nice Roman columns. They had a lot of wealth. But the apostles were doing the heavy lifting of actually going out to save people. We can all be wealthy and comfortable sitting in here in the yacht club, but that doesn't do anybody any good who are perishing without. So we have a we. We would not, brethren, have you to be ignorant of these things. Of our trouble which came to us in Asia while we were trying to rescue people that were opposing themselves, we were pressed out measure above strength insomuch that we despaired even of life. There's another interesting verse though right after that that Paul says about the we in 9. Look at this. In verse 9 he says, but, he goes, this is us, this is you, but we had the sentence of death in ourselves. Which is explaining verse 6, he says, and whether we be afflicted, it is for your consolation and salvation. Why were they afflicted? For somebody else's care, concern, and love, and their salvation. He says, we had the sentence of death in ourselves. The truth is we didn't expect to live.
We didn't even expect to survive. But we were doing it anyway. That's the heavy lifting of evangelizing, trying to actually not just play church, but rescue the perishing. Going into places that you wouldn't be comfortable going, doing things you're not comfortable doing, and saying things you're not comfortable saying, because if we don't, they will all perish. It's interesting, I told you last week that lately I've been fascinated with foreign policy and politics and war strategy. And so I mentioned last week that I've been looking into the fight for Fallujah, which is interesting. Because if you follow any kind of politics, they say, we need to get out of this endless wars. We need to get out of there. We need to get out of the Middle East. They've been fighting for 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years. They've been fighting since Paul was there. And we send our troops in there, our blood and treasure. And so the question is do we belong in the Middle East? Do we really need to be a part of these endless wars? And you're all going to have different opinions. But you might even be like me who says, it depends what day, I guess. Because some days I think, get them out of there. And some days I think, send them in there. Depending on what's going on. So interestingly, one of the testimonies from the soldiers for the fight for Fallujah, as they were going building by building, losing their brothers who were being shot by people who opposed themselves, came across one of the rooms that was a torture chamber of their own people. Muslim against Muslim, it was a torture chamber. He said it was so disgusting. There were instruments of torture. There were limbs, there were fingers, there was instruments for electrocution, and blood splattered all over the wall from the struggle. We went in as Americans to rescue them. Because who else will? The question is wouldn't it be unrighteous of us who have the capability to not go in and rescue these people? They have no hope. You speak against the government and they will dig your eyes out slowly one by one, electrocuting you as they do it. And then fingers begin to be removed slowly. Wouldn't it be unrighteous for us to do nothing? The interesting part of it is they said during these things that some of the high-ranking officials, Oliver North actually admitted that he used to regularly carry suicide pills. Some of our secret operatives, the operators, carry suicide pills. Some of the assets that we have within the government carry suicide pills. Because they know if they are found, they will be tortured horrendously until they either give up the secrets or they just have their will with them until they finally die a miserable, painful, torturous death. And so our boys actually take with them suicide pills. And isn't that what the Apostle Paul said? We carry with us the sentence of death. If the nations of this world find it so much so to go in and rescue other people who they don't know to the point of death, how much more should we not represent the kingdom of heaven? The question is, are you willing to leave the yacht club? And maybe you're not even a part of the yacht club. Maybe you don't even believe any of this at all. Maybe you're just an unbeliever sitting in the chair with hostility against the whole thing. So I would say to you, take the medicine. Or else.